of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Bradpool, and Judge Hallbrooks. The Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding.
Thank you. Welcome, and you may be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I know that I have two experienced lawyers for the first case. You each have 15 minutes. State your name when you start your argument and who you represent. 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Madam Marshall, will you please call the case?
First case this morning is A22-0193, State of Minnesota versus Ronald Anthony Fault.
Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brianna Bergstrom. I am here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Ronald Fault. This is an appeal of the district court's order denying Mr. Fault's motion to suppress all of the evidence as a result of an unlawful search and seizure. Now, the district court made three legal conclusions that are in error, and the first is where I'll plan on spending most of my time today discussing with you. That first one is that the informant was a concerned citizen and thus presumed reliable. The second legal error was that the arrest of Mr. Fault was supported by probable cause. And the third conclusion was that the search of Mr. Fault was lawful. Now, just real briefly, as for the standard of review, when this court is reviewing pretrial motions to suppress the evidence, this court independently reviews the facts and determines whether, as a matter of law, the district court erred in not suppressing the evidence, which it did in this case. Turning to the informant tip. Now, Officer Quanback testified on page 8 of the transcript as follows, quote, "A father called us to advise that between approximately 8 and 9, an adult male named Anthony Fault would be selling methamphetamine to his son, a Subway employee." That is the extent of the informant tip in this case. So the question then, when looking at this informant tip, is it reliable? And there's really two main criteria that you look at. One is the identification of the informant, which is either the actual identification or the identifying information that it provided. The second part is you look objectively at the bases for the informant's knowledge. So you ask, how did they know? How did they come to know about this information? What additional facts are they providing in support? Now, the informant tip in this case fails and is not reliable for at least four reasons. The first one, this is not a, quote, concerned citizen, end quote. In State versus McGrath, which is a case that both the state and respondents cited to as a standard, and it's frequently used in a lot of other cases discussing informant tips, this is how it describes a concerned citizen. A concerned citizen is an informant who provides information in his or her capacity as a witness to a crime, for whom a law enforcement officer is relieved of having to establish credibility and veracity independently through corroboration or a history of providing reliable information.
Well, it's my understanding with these 911 calls that the telephone number of the person who's calling comes in. So the dispatch person would have the telephone number of the person who called. He says that he's the father of a teenage boy, son, who works at Subway in Richfield. And so it wouldn't take very many steps to go from that information to knowing who this person is.
Well, Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record if they have the phone number of this informant or not.
It is undisputed he called 911.
He called the dispatcher, correct, yes. But even though the case law supporting whether the informant is identified or not, the furthest chain that I could find is an employee of a place calls in. For example, in the State v. Davis case and in City of Minnetonka v. Shepherd. Both of those were unnamed, but they said, "I work for either the gas station," or I think he said he was an attendant at the Q station. Mm-hmm. Said, "I work here and I observed what I suspect to be criminal activity." And in those two cases, the court held that that was sufficient to establish a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. So under the Terry standard, not even probable cause in that case. But in both of those cases, it was determined you could go to that place where the employee worked and hypothetically speak to that person, clarify the information if you needed to, and trace it back that way. Here, we're even a further step removed, right? He doesn't identify his son by name. All he says is that my son works at Subway. I don't believe he said he was a minor either, just said my son. So let's say there's 20 males that work at Subway. Before you could even confirm who that was, you'd have to figure out who the son was. And then from there, figure out if it was his father.
Well, that leads me to my next point. The tip was corroborated in all kinds of ways, as I list them. He said Anthony Falk was going to sell drugs. They go to the Subway, they see a lone young person, and then this man who they are able to identify as not Anthony Falk, I forget what his first name is, I'm sorry, Ronald Anthony Falk, at the Subway, and it's gonna happen between 8 and 9 p.m. And they're the only two people in the Subway, as I understand it. So isn't that a corroboration of the tip by the officers, an independent corroboration?
Your Honor, it's a very minimal corroboration at best, and it's not sufficient to be the type of corroboration that supports either a probable cause finding or a Terry, a reasonable suspicion of probable cause. And that's because the corroboration that did occur is easily obtained facts. So,
not really. How are they easily obtained?
So anyone could have driven by that Subway at that time and saw that it was Ronald Falk, if they know him, and that was about the extent of it. And
but the primary officer observed the situation for approximately an hour, isn't that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yeah. And that, from my perspective, that actually hurts against this in viewing the totality of the circumstances, because she observed them for almost an hour, and they were doing nothing noteworthy in there. They were doing their regular cleaning duties of the Subway, going about, and then they came out for a smoke break.
Well, they closed the restaurant.
Yes, it wasn't exactly clear, but she believed they had been closing down the restaurant. My understanding is the lights still may have been on in the background and stuff, but yes. And they came out, and she observed them discussing and having a smoke break, and she believed them to be smoking cigarettes. And then that's when she testified that she observed the hand-to-hand exchange. And when viewing that in light of the totality of the circumstances, a reasonable person would assume that's a lighter. When you're smoking a cigarette with someone, you could exchange.
With the tip that they've received, that there's going to be a drug sale?
Well, the reason why that's important, Your Honor, is because that's not a reliable tip. There is no case law that says in this situation, an unnamed informant who says, my son is going to, or this person is going to sell to my son, is a reliable tip. And the reason why, regardless of whether he was identified or not, the more important part, I believe, is that he did not report any witnessing of criminal activity. So in every case that I found...
I wanted to ask you about that, Ms. Bergstrom, because you began talking about a concerned citizen, and of course there are different types of informants. But you said the question is reliability. I mean, isn't that really what is at issue here? I mean, even if this person were deemed to be an anonymous informant, that would still be a basis for this if the person's deemed to be reliable in the totality.
Right, and reliability in that situation, regardless of whether they're identified or not, is based on observations. So you usually witness something, and therefore it's presumed reliable because the cop would say, for example, when you call in, well, how do you know that? Well, because I just saw it.
Well, that's a concerned citizen. Categorization.
Absolutely, right, which we don't fall into because we have no observations of any criminal activity. So, for example...
But my question isn't that. Let's say we set that aside because there wasn't observation of direct criminal activity. Why, if this were an anonymous informant, would it not still be a valid tip if there are other indicia of reliability?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe there is other indicia of reliability. Not only is he not identified by name, he doesn't give enough identifying factors to be there, to be reliable. Second, this is not no observations of criminal activity. And then third, I think the district court's finding that he assumed he was calling in with the intent to aid law enforcement for the safety of his son, that's a presumption. That's not in the record. And I think it's really telling how he reported the tip as well. He said, at this time, Ronald Falk will be selling methamphetamine to my son. Not that my son is going to be buying methamphetamine, my son is doing methamphetamine, I'm worried about my son. Nothing about that was in the tip. And when you're looking from a reliability standpoint, it's hard to, you can't just make these assumptions based on stuff that's not in the record, especially when you're dealing with the Fourth Amendment, and the whole purpose of that is to ensure that, you know, cops are doing their job and that the investigation is being fulfilled. So in a situation like that, had he given his, you know, identifying information, maybe the dispatcher could have called back and said, okay, you know, give us a little bit more information about this, which that's actually talked about in the City of Minnetonka case. It says in here, by so describing himself, the caller knowingly gave the police a way of verifying that the caller was who he said he was. Presumably, if the police had had time and had planned on using the information for something involving a greater intrusion, i.e. beyond that of a Terry stop to probable cause, then that occasioned by a stop, and police would have called the station back and verified that the call had been made by the attendant. So this is the one where the employee at the gas station called in. Didn't report themselves by their name, but said, I work here. And in another case that is helpful in this is the, excuse me one second here, is the Botello case. In that case, the citizen had observed multiple vehicles frequently stopping at the neighbor residence and was suspecting, had suspected that there was drug trafficking going on. And in that report, even though the person was anonymous, they said, I'm worried about the possibility of narcotics trafficking taking place as a neighbor. And so it was worrisome, and there was a concern, a citizen concern for safety in that case. Now,
so let me follow up on that for a second, counsel. So looking at the Ross factors, which we would apply if we consider this to be anonymous tip, we do have a father essentially reporting his son engaging in criminal activity. So isn't that at least similar to some information that indicates he's going against his own self-interests? And it also helps law enforcement, which is another theme that we see in the analysis of anonymous tips.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think if he was concerned for his son's safety, he should have identified his son and said, my son is buying the methamphetamine.
Those are great hypotheses, counsel. I mean, yes, that makes the tip even more reliable. What I'm struggling with is you aren't, you know, really coming to grips with what the district court found to be reliable and our review of that reliability. Because this is a father reporting his son engaging criminal activity. It is helpful to law enforcement to receive this, and they did obtain, during the course of that one-hour observation, some significant corroboration of father's tip.
Well, Your Honor, I still think in the tip he did not implicate his son. Other than saying it was my son, he did not say he was going to be engaged in this drug transaction at all. He said it's Mr. Falk is selling methamphetamine. And so to me, that is not a statement that really implicates his son.
Well, he said, according to the factual findings made by the district court, would be selling methamphetamine to his juvenile son.
Yeah, Your Honor.
At a specific Subway store in Ridgefield.
So my review of the transcript from the testimony is juvenile was not in there at all. The officer said he would be selling, or the dispatch informant said, to my son. Now, it was then carried over through the transcript that it was a juvenile, which was confirmed after the stop. But either way, he just said, to my son. But still, I don't believe that implicates the son enough to establish reliability of the informant tip.
On page 22 of your brief, you ask us to find Officer Quambeck's testimony not credible. Is there any case law that says we, as a reviewing court, should substitute our views on credibility with the finding by the district court as to who's credible and who isn't?
Your Honor, it is a very, very high standard. It's rarely done, only when there's clear error, as in it's not supported.
Perjury or lying, maybe, but...
Right. But even without that, even if we do consider the testimony, I still don't believe that there is enough here with the unreliable informant tip and the hand-to-hand transaction to support probable cause.
I'm still trying to understand why you think the tip is unreliable when the officers went and observed at that subway what the tipster said they would see.
Because the observations that were corroborated, those are easily obtained facts. And in State versus Albright, it makes that a point, and it found in that case that that was not sufficient. These were
The cases that you cited as I was reviewing them seem to, the tipster is a confidential, reliable informant, and those are typically people who have criminal charges hanging over their head and they're trying to work them off. That's not what we have here.
Your Honor, I don't think State versus Albrecht was a CRI, confidential, reliable informant case. I believe in that case, it was just a tip that was reported, and it was easily identifiable information, such as this is the person at this address driving this car. Those are facts that could easily be obtained, and they don't corroborate any criminal activity, which leads me to my other point on the corroboration. This hand-to-hand transaction is not the type of corroboration of criminal activity that you see, for example, in State versus Hawkins or State versus Smith. In both of those, it involved transactions, but they are much more indicative of criminal activity. So in State versus Hawkins, the appellant was riding around on the bicycle on the corner, making a lot of loud noises and distracting or attracting people in to sell narcotics. And the officer said, based on my training and experience, that is a common technique used when you're trying to sell narcotics. And in State versus Smith, similarly, five different cars showed up to a known crack house. Someone came out to the car, real briefly went back inside, and the officer said, based on training experience, that is a sign of criminal activity and drug transactions. Here, looking in the totality of the circumstances, you have two men who are doing their closing duties inside, nothing noteworthy. They come outside for a smoke break, and there's a, you know, a hand-to-hand transaction that presumably was a lighter for their smoke break. And so you don't get the same kind of corroboration of criminal activity like you do in the other two cases. And I see my time is out, so
you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. For respondent. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter.
What is the father?
What is the father? Thank you for bringing that up, Your Honor. As this court is well aware, I don't think there's any such thing as a perfect record in this case, but I do first want to clarify a factual matter. Appellant claims in his fact section and at oral argument this morning that there is simply no information about the identity of the caller in this case. But what is in the record is testimony from Officer Quanbeck, who is basically summarizing the 911 call and using titles as identifiers. So I am fully aware that appellant has received all the disclosure in this case, which includes the 911 call, police reports, which appellant references in their brief. There is no question that these people did exist. It was not a setup, as appellant has claimed in a footnote. These are not ghosts. These are real people, and in the transcripts, they are identified by the title. And so the father, in this case, identified that a specific male, named male, Anthony Falk, later confirmed to be Ronald Falk, is going to be at a particular place at the son's place of employment, the subway off of Penn, and Mr. Falk is going to supply a specific type of drug, methamphetamine, to the son. So hopefully that clarifies who the father is in this case. Certainly did call 911 and dispatch relayed that information to the officer. The officer summarized the tip for the district court in testimony. But that is one factual clarification I would like to make. The second clarification I'd like to make is that counsel has alluded that Officer Quanbeck noticed nothing noteworthy at Subway during the hour-long surveillance of the Subway store. And that is not entirely accurate. What the officer did note that was noteworthy is that there was clearly a young boy working at Subway in a Subway uniform. What was weird about the situation to Officer Quanbeck was that there was a man, an older man, identified as appellant in this case, wearing street clothes, but also appearing to maybe be helping the juvenile close the store, which the officer did note that was strange. That was suspicious. So that officer and several other officers who also responded to the same father's 911 call were surveilling for the purpose of intervening in a predicted drug transaction, which was later corroborated when they saw that hand-to-hand interaction.
So, counsel, if you don't mind if I interrupt. The father's tip included some information, didn't it, about this male, Falk, who's going to engage in the drug sale, that he was an ex-employee? Am I right about that, or is that not in the record?
I don't believe that's in Officer Quanbeck's testimony summarizing the 911 call. And I apologize. I've heard the 911 call, so I'm attempting to split my knowledge at the particular moment. If I could also address the third factual clarification. I think what the panel has alluded to so far is the reality of police investigations in the field in real time as they're responding to calls and pleas for help. And the 911 call in this case does constitute, even if you look at the cold record, the cold testimony of the summary of the 911 call, the 911 call in this case certainly constitutes an urgent plea for help from police to intercept the drug transaction of a son who is about to be sold methamphetamine. And that is such an urgent plea that the father says is going to happen within the hour. Please intervene. And another piece that goes to the urgency of the tip and in real time is that essentially, what the father did in this case is implicate his son, saying, my son is about to buy and then possess illegally a narcotic in this case. So to follow the thread of the question so far, if this court determines, which it should not, but if this court determines that the father does not constitute a concerned citizen in this case, the reliability piece certainly is bolstered by the corroboration that this court has already summarized.
So back to my initial question, you think the father's a concerned citizen, but if not that, an anonymous tipster?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Another theme in probable cause case law and reasonable suspicion case law is that anonymity seems to be a spectrum. There's a difference between known, meaning a CRI or something like that, and knowable. And knowable is akin to known, essentially. That's why all the cases where a particular 911 caller is traceable, that aids reliability. It lends credence to the tip. And the same way in this case, there is no doubt that police could ascertain who the named individual was in the 911 call. And again, what we have in the record is not that police got an anonymous tip. The police got a tip from the title, the father in this case, which is a known individual.
I'm not sure that the classification of the person matters, you know, concerned citizen or something else. I think reliability is the key here, but is there a case you can direct us to where someone is deemed to be a concerned citizen where they did not actually observe criminal activity?
Your Honor, I would have to go through a fine-tooth comb with the case, all of the dozens
nothing
of cases that were cited. Not necessarily. But again, what is important there is a spectrum of sort of how close to known do you know an individual to aid their reliability, because that person can be held accountable in the future. And so I apologize if that doesn't answer your question. But another interesting point about the case law cited by appellant is in State v. Jones, J-O-N-N-E-S. There is a footnote that indicates that at present, there may not be much of a difference at all between a separate category of concerned citizen and that first Ross factor, which is a first-time citizen informant who is known and who is also presumed reliable. So let's say this court determines the concerned citizen status does not apply. The first Ross factor certainly could apply then. It's a first-time citizen informant who is also presumed reliable. But if this court does want to get to reliability and go through the Ross factors, the factors that specifically apply to this case are voluntarily coming forward with a tip, and certainly police corroborated every detail of that very specific tip, including identities as well. But I apologize, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, I can't recall a specific concerned citizen case.
That's fine. Thank you.
But the other interesting part about this case law is that appellant asserts that for reliability to be established, a particular 911 caller has to observe a crime, to witness a crime. And although that might be how McGrath summarizes the standard in this case, that's certainly not reflected in the plethora of case law on probable cause and reasonable suspicion. I mean, 911 callers can also relay secondhand information and still be held reliable. And other instances or facts in a particular case may lend credence to a tip that provides secondhand information. But in addition, to hold that a 911 caller is only reliable if they witness an entire criminal act, that has never been the standard here. The standard is actually more criminal activity. And instrumentalities of a crime may be witnessed, not necessarily a criminal act in general. And in addition, predictive information of a future crime lends much credence to reliability, and I believe that was the case in Illinois versus Gates. And this court simply can't ignore the proven correct predictive information supplied in the 911 call by the concerned father.
Let's talk about the pat-down that occurred. What is the legal basis for that in this case?
Once we get to the pat-down?
Right.
Oh, Your Honor.
What justification did the officer have to do that?
Your Honor, there are several justifications because probable cause to support the arrest of the individual happened even before officers approached appellant in this case. And by approached, I mean, I believe it's Officer Anderson that actually did the approaching and the pat-down. So probable cause to arrest existed far before the officers actually drove up and interacted with the defendant in this case. And so because they had probable cause to arrest, the search incident to arrest exception applies for the pat-down. Pat-down is something that happens in every case where a particular individual is arrested. That is commonplace. But that's one basis. It is the main basis. That's the strongest argument. So I can stop there.
So this was never construed as a search for weapons or something of that sort?
Oh, it certainly was construed that way. It's still covered under Terry as well. And the officers in this case did testify that this was a weapons search. And the district court specifically found that Terry supports this as sort of a pat-down as well under Terry because of the furtive movements that is clearly seen in the video footage, which Your Honors obviously have reviewed it and may review it again. The furtive movements are clear. It's in the left pocket. The officer pats the left pocket in particular, and that's where he feels that cylindrical vial, which he believed contained narcotics. And about the particular pat-down, if we're in Terry land, which, again, we're not, it's search incident to lawful arrest, but if this court does entertain the Terry arguments in this case, the district court did make a determination of chronology there. The officer felt the glass tube and then determined it was narcotics, pulled it out. Oh, I believe the officer's language was, oh, wow, this is a rock of crack. So the district court did find chronology there.
What's the probable cause supporting the search incident to an arrest?
The probable cause is the same for the arrest.
I know, but what are the elements, the facts that support it?
The facts that support the arrest,
yes,
the underlying arrest?
The probable cause for the arrest.
Sure. Several things, Your Honor. First is the tip that came in from the father detailing exactly what officers would later observe, even down to the named defendant. appellant in this case. So you have the actual tip that says a specific drug is being handled by particular individuals at a particular place, particular time. All of that has been corroborated by police who have been observing in real time all of this transpiring. They see a hand-to-hand transaction, which is consistent with a drug transaction and inconsistent with something else, based on Officer Quanbeck's specific training and experience with narcotics in this case. Then, as officers approach, they see furtive movements. So furtive movements is not necessary to the probable cause analysis here, but it certainly helps. And so from the moment they see the hand-to-hand, probable cause to arrest exists. And then you also have furtive movements that a reasonably prudent officer would understand as a safety concern as he's attempting an interaction with a methamphetamine transaction. Thank you. And with my brief time remaining, I won't belabor the point, but again, this 911 call is an urgent plea for help to intervene in a drug transaction with a known juvenile. And so when this court makes its determination in this case, it cannot ignore the realities facing police in the field as they're doing these types of interactions. And so these types of cases sort of beg the question, what else could reasonable officers should have done in a circumstance such as this? I think that perhaps if they got the tip, went right to Subway and arrested everybody, that would not be lawful. But what the police did in this case is they did not do that. Instead, they observed, gained additional information and intel, confirmed identities, established probable cause, and then interacted with the parties in this case, which is not only reasonable, it is safe, and is certainly lawful. In sum, appellant's arrest was supported by probable cause, and this court should affirm the denial of the motion to suppress. If the court has additional questions, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, I can yield the minute.
I don't see any. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Bergstrom, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I have 3 points. Sorry, Brianna Bergstrom here on behalf of the appellant, Ronald Falk. I have 3 points I'd like to make in rebuttal. First, the state argues that our position is an entire criminal conduct needs to be observed, and that is not our position at all. It's any sort of suspected criminal activity that must be observed. Whether this is firsthand knowledge, secondhand knowledge, whatever it may be, but it's something that lends to the reliability of the informant's tip, such as how did you know that took place? And I'd like to point the court's attention to State versus Jones, which was a case cited by the state, and it's actually Your Honor Hallbrook's opinion. On site 3, it states, Jones asserts that because the concerned citizen was on friendly terms with the individual at the house and had an intimate familiarity with marijuana plants, we should conclude that a concerned citizen is not entitled to a presumption of reliability. But if the definition of a concerned citizen is an individual who, quote, provides information in his or her capacity as a witness to a crime, quote, it would be counterintuitive to argue that an individual's mere presence at a scene of a criminal activity, without more, is contrary to the presumption of reliability. And recent personal observation of incriminating conduct has traditionally been the preferred basis for an informant's knowledge. Here, there is nothing in the tip that supports any sort of incriminating conduct or basis for the informant knowing that that was going to take place. My second point, Your Honors, is
so you're suggesting it's not enough that a father is offering a tip about his son. The father needed to explain something like, I live with my son, or I overheard my son on a phone conversation, or I read my son's text messages. Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor. To the first part, I believe your first question was to the identity aspect, which
well,
certainly
I mean,
would
I'm
help,
setting aside that because that wasn't what you were talking
yes.
about. You're talking about the reliability of a tip doesn't require observation of a crime, but it does require a need to examine the basis.
Absolutely, Your Honor. You are correct, and that's the purpose of the State versus McGrath concerned citizen standard of having some knowledge or basis for how you knew or how you came to know about that criminal conduct that you either anticipate is going to happen or that you observed has already happened. So in this case, I believe it's in the City of Minnetonka case versus Shepherd, the court talks about how the dispatcher could have asked for some more questions about, okay, how do you know that? Did you see methamphetamine? Did you see Mr. Falk selling methamphetamine at some point? Do you work at the subway? Did you see a tip?
And I can't agree with you more. That would have made the tip more reliable. I guess what I'm struggling with is it's not in the facts here, but there are other facts that did yield some corroboration of the father's tip, specifically during that 1 hour of observation.
Yes, Your Honor. Very, very minimal corroboration, and not the type of corroboration, certainly not the type to meet a probable cause standard, and also not the type to meet a Terry standard, which leads me to my third point about the Terry standard in this case. I would direct Your Honors to State versus Brazil, which, although it's an unpublished case, it talks about how you don't even get to Terry in that case because there was no investigative stop. The officer came on the scene and immediately essentially arrested the defendant. He was not free to leave. We have a very similar situation in this case. The officer Anderson approached, put Mr. Falk's arms behind his back. It was over. He was seized. And even in the state's brief, I believe it's on page 8, but maybe off on that there. But in their brief, actually, I have it right here. Yes, page 8. They state, appellant and respondent agree that appellant was seized and arrested at the moment Officer Anderson placed appellant's hands behind his back. That was immediately upon Officer Anderson getting to the scene. So, and with regards to the futile movements, Your Honor, I have watched the tape over and over, and I do not see any evidence of futile movements.
I think you mean furtive.
Furtive moments, yeah, movements, yes. I would hope Your Honors watch it again if you have any questions about that, but those were not there to justify this pat-down, and the methamphetamine was not immediately apparent. So to answer Your Honor's question, there was no exception met here for the pat and frisk, even if we do get to the Terry standard. So with that, Your Honors, we respectfully ask that the district court's order be reversed and that all evidence as a result of unlawful search and seizure, fruit of the poisonous tree, and there is no probable cause in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. The case was well briefed and well argued. We appreciate your efforts on behalf of your clients, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days. Thank you very much.